The Guardian.
Welcome to Guardian Football Weekly. Today, Marco Silva gets the boot and it's all Everton's fault. On the pitch, who needs Sanchez as Arsenal breeze past Palace? Jose praises Mike Dean as United beat the Worm Eaters, and Aguero scores with his hair as City win. Elsewhere, Pep gets fired from Oxford, PSG lose a game, your questions feedback corner, and we pay tribute to Jimmy Anfield. All that on today's Guardian Football Weekly. And we have a panel this morning. Barry Glendening, nice to see you.
To see you, nice.
Paolo Bandini, how are you?
I'm good. I don't have a great catchphrase to come back at you with like Baz did.
That's almost a catchphrase in itself, isn't it? Philippe Auclair, bonjour.
Bonjour à toi.
Literally just as we all sat down and got a coffee, the news came through that Jimmy Armfield has lost his battle with cancer at the age of 82, played 627 matches in 17 years for Blackpool, was part of Sir Ralph Ramsey's victorious squad in 1966, was diagnosed with cancer for a second time last year. A statement from Blackpool says, Blackpool's deeply saddened to learn of the passing of its record appearance holder and vice president, Jimmy Armfield. Our heartfelt condolences go to Jimmy's wife and his two sons, Duncan and John, and the rest of the Armfield family at this time. He made his England debut May 1959, went on to win 43 caps, captain his side on 15 occasions. I think we all know him better as a broadcaster, yeah. And he had such a glorious voice. Mm-hmm. And in a world where a lot of co-commentators aren't particularly good at it, he was brilliant.
Yeah, I think the master. So I think we all knew that he was ill and gravely ill. I think there's the sadness is very real. He's one of these people who seem to federate around him. Saying, oh, Jimmy Armfield is on the commentary. That's wonderful. We know we're going to have a great time. A bit like Bill McLaren was for rugby. Mm-hmm. It's like this kind of gentleness and knowledge and humility in the commentary. It's absolute master of it. So very, very sad.
You know, sort of a footballing national treasure, I suppose. I used to love listening to him do co-coms on the radio. I would almost prefer to listen to a game he was co-coming on than watch it on TV. That's how good he was. He loved Blackpool. I think he was, you know, slightly heartbroken at the way the club was being run. And, he'll be missed. I'm sure there'll be plenty of tributes to him in newspapers during the week. And, you know, much like there were for Cyril Regis this time last week, because they're both much, much loved individuals in the football landscape, and may they rest in peace.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting comparison to draw, isn't it? Because a lot of people said about Cyril Regis, no one ever had a bad word to say about him, and I think it'll be exactly the same for Jimmy Armfield, certainly from people who knew him better than any of us. It always seems trite to move from sad news onto the football, which is why we're here, though. I suppose let's start with Marco Silva. Lost his job yesterday. They'd only won 5 points out of a possible 33, one win in 11. The Watford statement was interesting, Paolo, yeah. Wasn't it? The catalyst for this decision is that unwarranted approach, something which the board believes has seen a significant deterioration in both focus and results to the point where the long-term future of Watford has been jeopardised.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of feels a bit, disappointing to me, the whole sort of approach to managers in the last couple of years. Obviously, what happened with Mazzarri, with hindsight, you sort of think that he was accused of not living up to something when fundamentally the results have not been all that much different. But as you say, it's a sort of statement that feels rather coded. And
doesn't seem that coded. Well, it seems like Everton, you shouldn't have done that.
You wouldn't need an Enigma machine to crack that particular one.
Maybe Paolo's not very good at coding things, you know.
But yeah, it's I don't know, childish is the word that sort of comes to mind with that. It doesn't feel very sort of like a mature way of dealing with things as a football club, but there you go.
It's interesting though, Baz, because my instant reaction is there's no continuity, managers don't get an opportunity, it's ridiculous. But most Watford fans, gauging from social media, which is dangerous to do, and the ones that we spoke to on the radio yesterday, I heard from the radio yesterday, were like, we're quite pleased he's gone.
Yeah, I'm inclined to think Watford were perfectly entitled to sack him, you know. His head was clearly turned by Everton. He wanted to go to Everton. And if he wanted to go to Everton, he meant it, he didn't want to be at Watford. He never did anything to suggest he wanted to stay at Watford, even, you know, issuing bland statements saying, you know, my job is with Watford and until that situation changes, etc., etc. He never said anything like that, as meaningless as these things tend to be when managers or players say them, when you know their head's been turned by somebody else. And the fact of the matter is that Watford's results went off a cliff as soon as Everton expressed an interest in him. Watford are now 4 points worse off than they were this time last season under Matt Sarri, despite their great start to the season. So managers have been sacked for a lot less. Watford managers in particular have been sacked for a lot less. So they're entitled to get rid of him. They had the replacement lined up. Javi Gracia. Marco Silva isn't going to suffer particularly adversely out of this. He's got his payoff. He'll get another job, no problem. And he may even get a better job. So I think it's not that big a deal.
Richarlison sent a tweet. Did you see it, Philippe? Here it is.
No,
it was
didn't.
Just simply the angry face emoji. Ooh. Just that, just the face with the eyebrows down and the sad face. So he was sad about it.
Is he one of those players who were said to have had their heads turned as well and who wanted to follow Silva wherever he wanted to be?
Well, on the radio yesterday, Miles Jacobson from Football Manager, who's a big Watford fan and knows quite a few of the players, I asked him that very question and he burst out laughing, as many of our interviewees do on our radio show when I ask them a question. He said that Richarlison will stay at Watford for a season or two and then go somewhere a lot bigger than Everton. But if Richarlison doesn't up his game, because his form also has gone off a cliff since Everton took an interest in Marco Silva, then I would suggest he won't get a bigger club than Everton.
I'm wondering if it has also been this, you know, going off the cliff has to do with the kind of football that Silva was also promoting at Watford, which was so intense, physically speaking, that when you do not quite have the same level of confidence, perhaps, in your manager as you did, this extra mile that you're asked to run all the time, which was the case on the pitch, well, you can't quite do it anymore. And it really felt like they were not playing with the same kind of heart and desire to use that than before. Suddenly, they're not the same physical impact that they had at the beginning of the season, where they were quite frightening at times.
Yeah, but are they playing with any more intensity than Liverpool, say? I mean, who's pressing the most? Who's running the most?
As the teams from, we would call sort of mid-table, I don't think that any of those play with quite the same intensity and physicality as Watford.
And psychologically, it's much more tiring to run without the ball than with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't take any energy to make a run, but to track a run feels very tiring.
Yeah, but then there's also, you know, that in the sort of same spirit as that, there's the fact of that you are a mid-table team and what keeps you making those runs in the second half of the season. If you're Liverpool, it's the excitement of going after trophies, going after Champions League position, things like that. If you're 10th, it's a little bit harder to feel that drive always.
Javi Gracia. Has signed an 18-month contract, has been out of work since leaving Rubin Kazan last June.
Mm-hmm.
He spent two seasons with Malaga and worked in Greece, the 10th manager to work for Watford under the Pozzo family. Do we know any more about him, or shall I wait for
Steve? To be honest, I think an awful lot of people will become great specialists in Javi Gracia in about 2 hours' time.
This morning.
Oh, great.
I think the only thing that I know is I vaguely remember when he was at Malaga and he did all right. I mean, they finished actually mid-table or in the top 10 when he was there. But other than that, I must say, I've just looked at the clubs. He's been at the specialist of Olympiacos Volou, Kerkiria, Almeria and Cadiz and Pontevedra. Could tell us a lot about him, but I can't.
Well, he was at Malaga for a few seasons, took them from the bottom of the table to two top 10 finishes, which for Malaga on their budget is pretty remarkable achievement. He famously masterminded victory for Malaga over Barcelona at the Nou Camp and a 1-0 win in the 2014-15 season. And talking about that win in an interview with Sky, he sort of gave an indication as to how he operates. So he said, in certain moments, it's important to drop to a low block, but this has to be done all together as a team. It's important to remember not to stay too deep. In other moments, it's important to press, but the really important thing is to press as an entire team. The spaces in the central zone have to be closed down because that is the area where Barcelona can really hurt you. And the general consensus seems to be that his teams are kind of solid and well organized rather than particularly spectacular.
So he's Samuel Aladice or Aladicio?
Possibly, yes. He speaks very good English as well. Apparently he...
So does Big Sam.
Yeah. Well, the suggestion is that Gracia possibly speaks better English than Big Sam. I think he said the reason his tenure at Rubin Kazan ended in failure is because he had so many nationalities in the dressing room. I think he said he had 14 different nationalities, four or five different translators, and it just he couldn't get his ideas across because... It was just they were all being lost in many different translations.
You'd need such a big dressing room as well, wouldn't you? Would all the translators have? Would they have a? Would they have a top on with the initials of the player they were translating for, or their own initials? It gets very confusing. On the pitch for Watford, they lost 2-0 at Leicester. This sparked all of this.
Leicester were on our seventh.
Yeah.
Glory be, Claude.
He's done well, hasn't he?
Wonderfully well. Not surprised at all.
I was surprised.
As regular listeners to this pod, remember.
You're right. you deserve some credit where I think the rest of us...
No, he deserves some credit.
You both deserve credit.
Okay.
Certainly more than me. I reckon more than Barry. I don't want to put ideas into your head. I was pretty indifferent when Puel got the Leicester
probably
job.
Probably was as well.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I presume you're indifferent about everything, so...
Not everything.
Okay. Paolo, where were you on the Claude Puel indifference scale?
A solid six.
Okay, fine.
Mid-table.
Yeah.
It's like a quite Leicester-ish, actually.
Exactly, yeah.
Arsenal 4, Crystal Palace 1.
I was there.
Oh, you were there. Do you want to talk about the game first, or the who's won out of Mkhitaryan Sanchez? Let's talk about the football first.
I did a thing that I'm now doing when I go to the Arsenal, but it's not a secret that I'm a gooner and I've got season ticket. And when I can, I do one half in the stands with the fans and one half in the press box just to get a better feel of everything. And I did the first half in the stands. That was an absolute pleasure because I could appreciate and enjoy it far more. And honestly, I got the feeling...
Do the people around you think they've done something wrong? You know, because you're never there at half time. Do they know you're going?
I sit with mates of mine who we've known each other for a very long time, so that's not a problem. The feeling, first of all, people around me were smiling, and smiling in a way which was very odd in a football ground. And the best way to describe it is like they were smiling like people who've been rummaging in the attic, and I found this amazing photo albums with these great pictures of them on the beach like 5-10 years ago. Oh, weren't we lovely? Look how sweet you looked. And it was like that. It was one of those happy, fuzzy moments for 45 minutes. It's highly recommended, honestly, because that's it's not very often that you experience these kind of things, especially at the Emirates.
Did anyone say...
It was beautiful.
Did anyone say during that period where you scored 4 goals in 25 minutes, whatever, and the Lacazette goal was glorious,
absolutely
lovely,
wonderful,
lovely move. Did anyone say, oh, why can't we do this every week?
No, because we can't. So I think people have now reached this point at Arsenal where all sense of hope has gone. But also all sense of anger has gone. So you're waiting for, you know, something is going to happen in the summer. We're pretty sure about that. People were talking about Mkhitaryan, thinking, yeah, that's quite good. Yeah, it's quite good. So there's a sense of almost like a calm.
Yes, but hang on.
I'm not joking. The Wenger brigade is now
Palace, if Bakary Sakho put Palace 2 up, right? I know that didn't happen.
Yeah,
I'm not sure it would have been the same. Well, we don't really mind anymore.
No, but
you know?
at the Emirates, the performances have generally been actually quite good.
Yeah, that's true. They've got a good record.
So it's the away supporters probably would feel very different. As you know, it's a different clan. But, you know, the game against Manchester United was a fantastic game. The win over Tottenham was a great performance. And there were some so-so games, but generally it went pretty well. So the atmosphere has changed very much. It's one of resignation, I think, in many ways. So that's why the first half against Palace felt... Because I think that many people I did, were a little bit anxious because Palace are, you know, in a great run, very well organized. They've got pace as well.
I mean, they were very bad in the beginning.
But I mean, you have got to say as well, I think Hodgson has got something like 17 players to choose from, and he's missing some of his really big guns. They're all, and he's lost Cabaye now as well. Mm-hmm. Which is
very hard to keep Monreal quiet at corners, though, isn't it? I mean, who could defend that? Well, that was a good win for them. And actually, the race for the top four is, you know, people sort of write Arsenal off. I know they're a few points behind, and then everyone says, Spurs are guaranteed. But actually, you know, still,
they're only 3 points behind Spurs.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's not enough to make the top four, by the way.
You're saying
Spurs aren't in the top four either right now.
That's a very good
point.
You're saying that the Arsenal fans are pretty happy about the Sanchez-Mkhitaryan thing.
Do you think
that was just because Arsenal were winning?
No, I think there was a sense like, let's get it over with. I mean, I think everybody's really annoyed that he's going to Manchester United. It's a repeat of the Robin van Persie situation, so that's not good. On the other hand, it's fairly obvious, just like Marco Silva, you know, being sacked, that the player, his heart was not into it. His behaviour had been questionable, shall we say. And there are many people who would think that Mkhitaryan is, in a way, is a perfect fit for Arsenal, very technical player.
Well, it's a transfer that almost already happened. Indeed, I think it was, you know, the notion was that Sanchez might have been moved on in the 2016 in the summer, and Mkhitaryan would have come in, was something that Wenger was mooting. So in a way, it's just sort of the same thing happening later. I disagree with me, Philippe, if you do. I don't get the sense of the Arsenal fans that I know that anyone sort of wildly excited about Mkhitaryan. I think what a lot of people feel is that Sanchez was going anyway. As Philippe just said, no one's been enamoured with his attitude and behaviour lately, so everyone's kind of okay to see the back of him. And at this point, getting anything was something. And actually, certainly I would say that the money, it's become totally meaningless. You can say, we could have had 30 million for him. What does that mean? The market is, prices are changing so rapidly that could effectively be absolutely pointless money. Whereas what you've actually got is a good player. You've got a good player potentially in return. That's a more interesting prospect than some money that might or might not become something.
Who had 2.5 years on his contract and was probably worth 35 million anyway. So people who say Sanchez cost nothing, talking complete rubbish, basically.
Speaking of players with, you know, bad attitudes who aren't putting it in, Ivan Gazidis has flown to Germany, apparently, to discuss a £50 million buy of Aubameyang, who's twice been left out of Dortmund's side for disciplinary reasons this season. He didn't return to the squad for Friday's 1-1 draw at Hertha Berlin. He was pictured playing five-a-side, wearing a Dortmund shirt with Ousmane Dembele's name on the back. Mm-hmm. So does he seem like a sensible man to bring in, Barry?
Well, I said before, I don't see the logic of it at all, because A, he's a disruptive influence in the dressing room. B, he's 28, which would suggest he's not going to stop being a disruptive influence in the dressing room, because if he was going to stop, he'd have stopped by now. And C, I just don't think Arsenal need him. They've got Lacazette, they've got Giroud. I'm not sure how injured he is, but
he's Arsenal injured. It means you never know how injured he is.
Well, okay. I just don't think they need him.
So for
the amount they're going to have to pay and the wages they're going to have to pay and the potential trouble he's going to cause, and he has a long history of causing trouble, I'm always wary of clubs bringing in renowned troublemakers, because these guys tend not to see the error of their ways and start behaving suddenly. It's like, you know, women going out with a bad boy, you know, she thinks she can change him. Nah, never.
Is there any personal...
I'm not a bad boy. I wish I was. I wish I had some edge. You know, I should chew gum vigorously and wear a biker jacket, lean against a Mustang car.
Is that edge? Is getting a mouthful of Hubba Bubba?
Yeah. That's the only thing.
Jonathan says, your idea of a bad boy is basically being one of the T-Birds. You're Kinnicky, aren't you? There you are. I've forgotten entirely what we're talking about. Aubameyang, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I shared some of what Baz is saying there, and as much as how does he fit, I think tactically there's certainly a question to be asked of, are we not sort of putting together two players here now in him and Lacazette who are fairly similar in what they bring to the team? I think the stuff about him being a bad boy, sure, that's part of the conversation as well. I think there's another question there, which is if Wenger was going this summer, then why are they suddenly adding all these players to a team when you get a new manager? You might have a different vision anyway. But on the other hand, Aubameyang is an absolutely relentless goal scorer who's done it a lot in high-end competition in the Champions League. He's basically had the same sort of record he's had in the Bundesliga. So he's not someone who's a flat-track bully. He's a phenomenal goal scorer. And I think that the opportunity to add that to your team is generally always a good thing for a football team.
Well, yeah, he's a 40 goals a season, yeah. Minimum. And it's something like his rhythm is something like 14-49 would be sort of normal for him. Two things. First of all, I think that this show, if it goes through, the influence that Sven Mislintat has got at Arsenal now, the fact that Mkhitaryan, former Borussia Dortmund player, is arriving, that Aubameyang, Borussia Dortmund player, is also on his way, if that's the case, of course. I'm not absolutely sure that Wenger himself was enamoured with the idea of getting Aubameyang. I'm like Barry, I've got grave doubts about him because I remember we interviewed him about a couple of seasons ago. He was already saying some very strange things, and I think things which are completely out of order in the media about his ambitions and so forth. And for me, it's quite clear that if he goes to Arsenal, Arsenal will be yet another stepping stone for him because his ambition is to play for Real Madrid. What's the surprise? You know, and he went public about that. And
that's
also,
okay, isn't it? I mean, you're allowed to be.
I know. Yeah, there's the way.
We all want to work for the Daily Mail, and this is a stepping stone.
But every player wants to play for the best team in the world, and that's quite natural. It's the way you go about it. And when you sort of are there in public, under employment with Borussia Dortmund, and showing what I think is complete disrespect, because the words I'm remembering were actually, I think, very badly chosen, and he's not a stupid guy at all. The other thing I'm wondering, why did you then spend so much money on Lacazette if you're going to have somebody who is also an out-and-out striker? Because the thing is, Lacazette might be used perhaps on the flank or whatever, might. Aubameyang, down the middle, that's all he plays. If you look at his stats with Dortmund, all his goals have been scored in a number nine position, every one of them. So what do you do with Lacazette?
You've got to sell
him, just spent so much money. What?
You've got to sell him, haven't you? Unless you can play two up front.
He's an excellent player, and actually I think he's in a team that has had many problems. Lacazette has really not let anybody down.
Yeah. Who do you reckon is, if Barry's not the bad boy, who's the bad boy of the Guardian Football Weekly? I mean, it's definitely not me.
Well, it's Wilson, because in the episode of Seinfeld where George was pretending to be a bad boy, you know, with the letter jacket and the chewing the hubba bubba, leaning against the sort of muscle car, he also had a packet of, I think, orthopedic insoles in the car, which his girlfriend accidentally sat on or something. Oh,
but I also have orthopedic insoles.
Oh, well.
Not Rone?
Nah.
Nah. I mean, it's a pretty straight-laced affair, this, isn't it? Yeah. The baddest boy of Guardian football.
Could
Burnton?
You imagine Sid, perhaps?
Do you reckon?
I don't know.
With his garage,
with the right
full of
attire.
His carriage full of ham.
There is a picture of Sid, isn't there, from years ago in a leather jacket and shades that could suggest deep down there's a bad boy in Sid Lowe. Maybe we'll ask it. First question, are you a bad boy? See what happens.
Un hombre difícil.
Malo, I think so. I'm sad I have to now ask him that. Manchester United won at Burnley. Lukaku did very well for the goal, I thought. Excellent hold-up play, showed real strength. He's got a lot of criticism this year.
He's done a lot of that of late, hasn't he?
And a lovely finish from Martial as well. Burnley in a bit of a rut, but still, they're a good side, actually. So to go there and get 3 points, Jose should be very happy.
Yeah, it was interesting parallel. Lukaku did that, and his brother Jordan Lukaku had a very lovely little piece of footwork and then assist for Lazio's goal at the weekend. So a good weekend for being a Lukaku brother and setting up a goal. I thought it was an impressive, mature performance from both Lukaku and United. Actually, one that makes you think as well, not that he's not going to get in that team, because he 100% is, but exactly where does Sanchez fit into the United team? What's the shape of things there? Does he play on the right, which he hasn't played in for some time? Does he play through the middle, in which case where do you put Lukaku?
Does Martial or because Lingard's been excellent, hasn't he? He's can't really drop Lingard.
I think it's Martial who should really row away for his place, which is crazy because he scored in his last three games, which is all started. You would imagine that's it. Jose likes him now.
Mm-hmm.
He's got the best stats of his career in terms of, you know, in relative terms. Not just with Manchester United, but with Monaco in terms of, you know, minutes per goal and so on. I think he's up to 9 goals now, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look, Lukaku, never. I think he will stay as number 9 and he deserves to be. On the right, you would imagine, well, there's Lingard, who's played there. There's Rashford, who's played there. There's Juan Mata, who is still around and has played on the right of it 4-2-3-1.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's not Sanchez's good position.
No, I mean, he did used to play there at Udinese, but it's a long time ago.
Yeah, I mean, he's a,
he can't
he should play on the left.
Yeah, he can't
he has to play on the left. And who plays on the left? Anthony Martial.
Who's been brilliant.
Yeah, I know. So what do you do? Play him as a 10? Alexis is not a 10.
Hmm.
Not at all. And it means that, you know, I heard Mourinho saying, well, I wanted to bring competition for you know, attacking places. And I thought, really? You've already got competition.
Because most people have been saying since the Sanchez move that it's just absolutely brilliant for Manchester United. Is that oversimplifying it then?
Great to get a great footballer for nothing. Like that's never a bad thing. But yeah, it's just not straightforward. It's not like he's someone who you go, oh, there was a gap in their team and there he is. Like he's something they already have in some senses.
And Martial's contract, I think, expires in June 2019. So very soon.
Mm.
So, and I'm a bit surprised that there hasn't been any talk of him extending his contract, things like that. His position seems to be, I don't know, he's in the team, but I've never felt that he was, anyway, a Mourinho type of player. And he's been terrific, though.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Alexis coming in, of course, it's good news for Manchester United.
Jose Mourinho, I was driving home from my game, and Jose came on the radio, and he was asked a question, you know, how do you feel about that win? And his first line was, I'm just sad there aren't an extra set of fans for when the officials have such a good day. Mike Dean and his team were marvellous. And I just wondered if Jose, it was just like, just trying to dig out Arsene Wenger, just absolutely no, like totally crowbarred line in. I haven't even checked if Mike Dean was reffing that game, but it wouldn't surprise me if he wasn't.
So he wanted an extra set of supporters?
Yeah, for the officials. It's sad they weren't Manchester United fans, Burnley fans, and a set of fans in another tier for the officials to applaud advantages and, you know, sensible decisions, some common sense, letting the game flow, you know, those kind of things.
Right. I wasn't aware of that. And he wasn't being sarcastic.
We didn't sound it. It doesn't. It's quite monotone, isn't it, Jose, really? So hard to say. No, he wasn't being sarcastic. I think he was very... He'd won, so he was clearly happy with however the officials had been. Another note that we should say, I didn't realise sort of how important we were to the news agenda until the Sean Dyche worm-eating story came from one line below the line, which entered into Feedback Corner, which was then picked up by the Daily Mirror. Hello, Daily Mirror, who clearly listen, who then took the whole story of the worm-eating, which was then asked to Sean Dyche in a press conference, and Sean Dyche had to say he only used to put worms in his mouth and then spit them out. So,
yes.
Which is already a very strange thing to do.
Well, no, he used to hang them from the corner of that and then pretend to eat them to repulse teammates. And it did the trick because the story originated
on a Danish podcast called
The Danish Podcast.
Football Ministerial.
Yeah.
I believe.
So,
Who got very angry? We didn't. Not very angry. They got a bit sad. We didn't mention them by name and just called them a Danish podcast. So I just wanted to reference them again.
So, we said all sorts of... And I was writing about this, adding to the pile of waffle about Sean Dyche eating worms. Like, I pity a grown man at a press conference had to ask Sean Dyche about this. And can you imagine anyone asking the same thing of Sir Alex Ferguson in his pomp?
I know it's a different broadcaster, but you did once ask Pat Jennings what his favourite underwear was, didn't you, Barry? So, you know.
And I My toes are still curling over that.
Look, that'll do for part one. We'll be back in a sec. Welcome back to part two. Speaking of us setting the agenda, Barry, on Thursday, we were talking about Chelsea being in for Andy Carroll, and then John Bruin said, what about Peter Crouch? And we all sort of laughed. And then 4 hours later, that was the top news story.
Yes. And it isn't entirely out of the question yet. I think Chelsea have now targeted, having gone for Jan Koller, Kevin Francis, a couple of giraffes from London Zoo. Chelsea have turned their attention to Edin Dzeko, and there's talk that he will move from Roma to Chelsea. And if that doesn't happen, they may still go for Peter Crouch. Stoke have said they don't want Peter Crouch to leave unless they can get a replacement for him. Peter Crouch very much does want to leave and go to Chelsea, and why wouldn't he? Top up his pension. And it's a bit more glam than Stoke.
How do we reckon Peter Crouch?
And he's going to be on the bench at either club, so true. He might as well be on the Chelsea bench as the Stoke one. So, it's an interesting one. Chelsea's just desperation to get in a big centre-forward to have as plan B, as everyone's saying. So, Dzeko played for Roma last night in their draw against Inter, which Paolo may mention later in his Italian Football Corner. Or his Italian football piazza. And after the game, the Roma manager was asked about whether he'd, you know, was going to move to Chelsea, and he sort of straight batted it, said his transfers are nothing to do with me, but Dzeko's an important player to me, and I sort of intimated that he'd like to keep him. But it looks like Dzeko to Chelsea could be a runner, along with the Inter fullback, who's a
Palmieri.
Yeah.
Oh, my favourite, Emerson, Lake and Palmieri.
Mm. Yeah, Emerson, Lake and Palmieri. Yeah, they're both. Well, on that, Paolo, you know, you're an Italian expert. I don't want to go straight into your piazza, but if, you know, if we could just go near it.
Not only did, you know, the language change, but actually I got upgraded from a corner to a whole piazza. I mean, that's great. Yeah, I'll take that.
Now we're in the piazza with a massive dessert, reading Gazetta. I don't know who would do that, but Dzeko and Palmieri to Chelsea, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's happening. I find the Dzeko one sort of extraordinary. I mean, he has slowed dramatically after a very explosive start to the season. But for Roma, they're going to leave themselves in a real problem. As they're chasing a Champions League spot, and the talk at the moment is that they aren't so keen on Batshuayi coming the other way. They're going to have Patrick Schick, who is this young, extremely talented player they signed from Sampdoria, but who hasn't really settled yet, hasn't really started scoring yet. Questions about him being ready to lead the line. I don't see that they've got a ready alternative at all in the squad. They've already lost Mohamed Salah, of course, in the summer. I feel like it's a slightly bizarre move in terms of letting it happen in mid-season, because you're really potentially running up the white flag in terms of the Champions League challenge. But the reporting in Italy indicates that it's likely. I guess there is a valid case for, financially, as a business, you see an opportunity to move on a player who's not young, who is going to not be an appreciating asset going forwards, and you take it. But yeah, it's a surprising move from my perspective.
Away from the piazza to Burnley Boulevard, Ashley Barnes has also been mentioned as a possible. Look at Philippe's eyebrows go up. And to Wickham Way, Adebayo Akinfenwa sent this tweet. Woke up hearing the Chelsea rumours. I'm flattered, heart, but I've heard Conte don't allow chicken at the training ground. Sorry, can't do it. With four laughing, crying emojis. Hashtag for the love of chicken. on the pitch, Chelsea won 4-0 at Brighton, Barry, but it wasn't a 4-0 game, was it?
No, I don't think so. Chelsea probably should have had, Brighton probably should have had two penalties. They hit the post. There's a couple of near misses, but that's kind of indicative of Brighton's luck at the moment. They're finding goals very hard to come by. They've drawn an awful lot of blanks in the league this season, and it's difficult to see where their next win is going to come from. I would be worried about them. Chris Hughton didn't seem too concerned, and Chelsea's kind of a free hit anyway, but I would be concerned if I was a Brighton fan, just their inability to score on a regular basis. And having said that, Chelsea were very, very impressive. I was really impressed with Batshuayi, actually, the way he linked up with Willian and Eden Hazard. And Hazard was just outstanding again. So there's absolutely no shame in Brighton losing that game 4-0. If you saw the score, you'd kind of go, oh, they must have been thumped. But if you actually watch the game, they did reasonably well. But they need to start scoring goals. Well,
there's a lot sort of being pinned on Locadia, isn't there? Mm. Who they signed and is club record signing. But I find it a bit anxiously putting that on someone who's currently injured, who's coming in from a foreign league and who's going to have very little season to get up to
signed,
speed.
Signed, for $14 million, Jurgen Locadia from PSV. He
I
scored
also
9 in 15.
I'm going to throw in my Dutch goals caveat.
He could be the next Vincent Janssen. Philippe.
Oui.
Which goal was better, Lacazette's or Willian's? Lovely moves.
Can we have both?
No. I'd like you to pick.
Oh, come on, Daddy.
No. I'm sorry, Philippe.
Well, of course, I'll go for Lacazette's goal.
I don't think you're right.
Oh, no. And I'm probably wrong, which is probably wrong.
They both made me involuntarily groan with pleasure.
Oh, dear.
But occasionally, when there's a great goal, you just go, oh,
yes.
Like that. And they both made me do that, but Willian's slightly more. Spurs dropped points at Southampton, and they were poor. They were just bad. And Tottenham have this habit of looking really good for three or four games and then just not really turning up to a game, Philippe.
Yes, I must say that it's it was a very poor performance. I'm wondering if the conditions actually didn't have quite a lot to do, because it was really very, very difficult to play proper football in that rain. And it was really crazy. It was a flood, wasn't it?
Yeah, but a big condition was Ericsson wasn't there and Sissoko was.
Yes, and Sissoko, yes, I have to question myself, and I have to question Mauricio Pochettino more than myself as to how and why Moussa Sissoko is enjoying such a long run in the side. And I was talking to a Spurs supporter last night at Chile FD, at the FWA dinner, and sitting next to one. And he was baffled, as I was, by Moussa Sissoko's continued
I am baffled.
Presence in...
It's one of those where you start questioning whether you actually know anything about football at all, because he
can be... He was, for example, remember Euro 2016? He was terrific for France. But he's terrific in one particular role, which works in Didier Deschamps' team, and Didier Deschamps absolutely loves him. He's a player that managers love because he's big-hearted, he gives his all, extremely professional, and so on. Physically, extremely impressive as well. But technically, it's absolutely... He slows the game down. The number of touches for each ball he receives, then the decision he takes, usually...
He doesn't
pass
play the
ball backward, yeah. And he can't create. His crossing is appalling. His finishing is dreadful. And and he plays for Spurs. And it's a mystery to me. This said, I think Southampton actually acquitted themselves quite well, I thought.
Played much better football.
And, were perhaps a bit unlucky, should we say?
Both teams had a chance to win it towards the end. Sofyan Boufal, shot straight at the keeper, and then Harry Kane missed one from 6 yards. You'd expect him to score blindfolded. I think the game was kind of indicative of all the games played in the Premier League this weekend. There were some good performances by various teams, but there weren't any good games. I thought most of them were, possible exception of Chelsea-Brighton, I thought they all stank.
Really? That bad?
Do you want to discuss any more of them?
Well, no, I just thought it was...
No, I know, I'll take your point. Sometimes Match of the Day is brilliant and it wasn't.
Yeah.
I agree with that. Spurs...
I watched Chelsea-Brighton and I really enjoyed it, but... It was 4-0 and Brighton were totally outclassed, but they did their best. But I'm struggling to think of any single game played in the Premier League that was any good.
Quite liked.
As a contest.
Compared
to Leeds 3, Millwall 4.
Well, the West Ham game, perhaps?
I don't know. 0-0 last on Match of the Day.
1-1.
Or sorry, 1-1 last on Match of the Day.
I don't know.
Well, when Newcastle scored against City, that was quite fun for a bit, wasn't it? Just back to Spurs, they're favourites to sign Malcolm from Bordeaux.
Oh, gosh.
Philippe, we obviously all know everything about Malcolm, but for those listening who might not, well, I don't know why you're laughing. Can you tell me a bit more?
Well, that people at Bordeaux are extremely... the fans are not happy at all about it. That he's one of the reasons why they're not in the relegations yet. It's a club, actually, which, if I can actually say a word about that, because they've just appointed Gus Poyet as their manager. And the way he's been welcome, inverted commas, in French football is absolutely astounding. As in, people are tearing him apart, saying he's rubbish and all these sort of things. And French football will have, at one point, to lose its... sense of self-worth and insularity when it comes to foreign coaches. Because I tried to explain to them that actually he did, and as Barry will testify, quite a decent job with Sunderland, that he did a great job with Brighton until it finished, as we know, in unexplained circumstances, that he was not rubbished at AEK Athens either.
I think the circumstances of Brighton were explained, were just quite fecal, weren't they?
Well, we won't go into that.
Okay.
Don't want to go into that. But anyway, so Malcolm, still very, very young, but a goal scorer, proven goal scorer, a rare goal threat in a team that has hardly threatened at all, considered to be one of the hot properties in Ligue 1 and with an awful lot of suitors. I'm a little bit surprised. I hadn't heard about this one, this particular rumour. I know that Arsenal have been following him for quite a while.
It's just a rumour at this stage. Jonesy Boy says, actually, Barry, you made a face when Philippe said he thought Poyet did a good job at Sunderland.
I'm struggling to remember, actually, because Sunderland had been through so many managers.
When he arrived, Sunderland were 20th with 1 point out of 21. You survived, and not only that, but you were the first team to beat Mourinho's Chelsea at Stamford Bridge in the league, and you went all the way to the final in the League Cup. That was with Gus Poyet after beating Manchester United. That's not too bad after finding a team that was 20th in the league.
Just completely evaporated from my memory banks, apart from the League Cup final, which I was at.
Well, there you go.
It was Connor Wickham's score.
And the first game Chelsea at home, remember, was the derby against Newcastle, and you won.
I always beat them.
Jonesy says, is it just me, or is Dele Alli one of the worst midfielders in the Premier League this season?
I mean, I think taken literally it's just him, but he's not enjoying his finest moment of form, certainly.
Nope.
I think it was sort of reminiscent of a lot of Spurs players yesterday, where they just took an extra touch, tried to all do it. Happens to lots of teams when they're not playing well, that players just try and overplay, just don't play the easy pass and keep on moving.
And I think that I would probably say Ali falls very much into a category of player who is prone to that. I think he's a mood player. I think when he's switched on and is sort of playing with the swagger, then he's exceptional. And I think when he lets himself lose his head or get in that sort of over-ambitious mode, he can become a lot less
useful. His touch seems to desert him. The first touch would be great, then the second touch would be awful. Mm. It will lose the ball. It will take the wrong decision. And this is odd. But at other times, he will do this lovely pass with the outside of his boot exactly where it should go. And you think, oh, that's a lovely player. And then he does something awful. And it's been like this all through the season.
Manchester City 3, Newcastle 1. Not completely straightforward for City. Can we banish the idea that Pep Guardiola doesn't fancy Aguero anymore? Or is that still a thing?
Well, it's sort of weird that he... Has managed to get... He's on 20 goals for the season now, I think, in all competitions, despite the fact that he sort of hasn't quite been there all the time. Certainly, central, I think he's up to one goal every 94.9 minutes, which is just a rate that any player would envy, other than possibly Harry Kane. He's got a role at City. I think it would have been fascinating to see what would have happened with Aguero if Sanchez had gone to City. I think that would have been a genuinely... fascinating dilemma to see how Pep would have approached it and what his value judgment on all of the various options he had up front was. But Aguero has a very demonstrable role in that City team.
I didn't think Newcastle disgraced themselves. like they did in the corresponding fixture just before Christmas. But then that it's kind of tough to criticise Newcastle because it's this championship squad desperately trying to stay in the Premier League.
They finished with a team composed of players who all had were championship players.
Right.
Against City. Mm. That's saying a lot as to the amount of money that hasn't been spent on players for Rafa.
I saw today, actually, they've been linked with André Schürrle, the World Cup winning Borussia Dortmund striker who's fallen down the pecking order at the Westfalenstadion. Dortmund want to loan him out for 18 months and Newcastle would have to pay half his wages, which would cost them 70 grand a week. I think Everton are possibly also interested.
Okay. Oh, well, you mentioned Everton, and I know we've talked about the fans not being that excited about Big Sam. I mean, the one big thing from this West Brom game is the really sad injury to James McCarthy. He's been out a lot, just coming back. It was a complete accident. Salomon Rondon was clearly devastated by the challenge and showed a great deal of humility, actually, and humanity.
So, funny enough, someone tweeted me yesterday inquiring if I found it puzzling that more seems to have been made of the humanity being shown by Salomon Rondon than the fact that James McCarthy has suffered from a potentially career-breaking or career-ending leg break. I mean, my reply was that football is now such a toxic cesspit that anyone doing anything even remotely human or nice, like Rondon's perfectly natural reaction to this awful accident, is sort of, people make a big deal of it. Whereas, you know, there's not a huge amount you can say about James McCarthy's leg break beyond wishing him all the best. And
in a funny way, I suppose that what happens sort of visually when you watch something like that happen is, happily, the camera doesn't dwell on the injury for too long. And so what you share in as a viewer is the person reacting to it and what's what you're doing more than the person who's actually suffering.
Although it's an interesting point you bring up, because we were looking at all the Sunday papers yesterday, Barry, weren't we? And pretty much every single one of them, and I think barring The Observer, and I'm not just saying that to be a sort of company man, showed that exact photo, the picture of the leg being broken. And I don't know if I was just being oversensitive to think, why publish that?
Well, I think him lying on the floor with Jordan Pickford's horrified reaction as he calls for the medics is possibly a better image. You know, it tells the story, but in a different way than just the gruesome crumpling of the leg. It's kind of an interesting debate, you know?
Yeah, I think so. Anyway, look, we all obviously wish him well. Stoke 2, Huddersfield 0. A good start for Paul Lambert there, isn't it? It's a gripe of mine, and I don't know if any of you agree with it, that the Match of the Day commentator said it's 1,074 days since Paul Lambert last managed in the Premier League. And I just wonder why this obsession with using days as a unit. I know it is a unit of time, but it just means everyone has to sit there and go, how long is that? Why can't they just say 3 years? Because then we'll go, right, it's been 3 years. Why? You know, it's like this, he hasn't scored in 9,200 minutes. Well, can you just tell me how many games that is? Because then I can understand it.
It kind of stresses that it's been a very, very, very long time. When I wrote about Saido Berahino's goal drought, you know, I put it in minutes because it stressed.
You're part of the problem.
I am.
See, I like minutes more than I like days, because minutes, the point is, you could say someone played 15 games, but they might have been off the bench in 14 of them. So, like, saying minutes actually gives you a relevant idea of how much they were on the pitch.
And when I did the Berahino thing, worked out exactly how many different box sets you could watch in the time it had been then since he last scored. He still hasn't scored, by the way.
But so, in Lambert's case, I'm totally with you. It makes absolutely no bloody sense whatsoever.
Thank you, Philip.
It sort of conjures the image of him sat at home scrawling one day at a time on the wall.
Exactly. He's in a prison. He's got his own prison cell. Well, I think everyone's very pleased with Paul Lambert. I'm sure you, I've met him, I'm sure you have. He's a really nice guy. He was out of work when I interviewed him, and the amount of times he was, and obviously he's got great contacts, especially in Germany, but the amount of great managers he was spending time with to learn about the game and never stop learning about the game. I think a lot of people, even though his appointment was met with some sort of indifference, well, I hope that he does a great job.
He seems to get a lot of stick from his time at Aston Villa, which I think he didn't deserve. Aston Villa fans possibly might disagree with me, but as I recall, his hands were very much tied and he was working for an owner who was giving him no money to spend and basically asset stripping the dressing room. And there wasn't a huge amount he could do there. So, but as I say, Aston Villa fans may disagree, but I think he gets a very hard time.
It's at B. Glenn Denning on Twitter, if you'd like to disagree with him. West Ham, Bournemouth. Bournemouth living up to that cliche, you're never more vulnerable than just after scoring. So frustrating. Just watching it going, oh, you can't. Don't score and then just concede that goal.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes.
What do you want me to say?
Nothing at all.
Because it was quite extraordinary. It's like, it's not going to happen, is it? Yeah. It's not going to. It's happened. it's extraordinary.
Yeah. Swansea Liverpool tonight, obviously. Yeah. In the Football League, Aito Karanka secured his first win as Nottingham Forest manager with a 3-1 win at runaway leaders Wolves. Which ends their 13-game unbeaten run. Forest's first win in 7. Elsewhere, second place Derby were held to a goalless draw by fifth place Bristol City. Cardiff a third. They also drew 0-0 at Sheffield Wednesday. Villa made it 4 wins in a row, beating Barnsley 3-1 to go fourth. Game of the day was at Elland Road, Barry. Leeds were 2-0 down and down to 10 men at home to Millwall. They scored 3 times in the first 17 minutes of the second half to go 3-2 up. And then they conceded 2 in the last 3 minutes to lose. Craig says, can you please talk briefly about the fantastic nonsense of Leeds Millwall?
Well, I think the most fantastic nonsense I've seen is the reaction of many Leeds fans to the performance of Millwall's Steve Morrison, who used to play for them. He didn't score, but I think he ran. He's a tireless worker. I've seen him play a few times for Millwall. Tireless worker. Very popular with Millwall fans, not very popular with Leeds fans because he had an unsuccessful spell there, but he had a very successful afternoon on Saturday, and a lot of Leeds fans on social media seem to be very, very upset with him for goading the Leeds fans.
Because the Leeds fans weren't goading him
at all.
No,
Leeds fans never goad anyone.
No.
And it's possible some Leeds fans are the kind of fans who are quite happy to goad people but don't like being goaded back.
You can goad it out.
Yes, poor snowflake. But, I think a lot of them also think Morrison was instrumental in Lee Cooper getting sent off for Leeds. Because they think, some conspiracy theorists believe the ref was going to give Cooper a yellow card but reach for the red at when Morrison goaded him. So Morrison didn't score, but a lot of goading. His goading stats are higher than anyone else's.
Bottom place Burton lost 6-0 at Fulham, and Sunderland are almost out of the relegation zone. It's a positive way of saying you're still in the relegation zone, Barry.
Thank you.
You beat Hull. You're now level on points with them. That's exciting. And a Middlesbrough fan was arrested for allegedly urinating in the opposition team's goalkeeper's water bottle and then throwing it back on the pitch, which is a charming...
How did he end up in his possession in the first place?
There was a mini pitch invasion, according to producer Jonathan, and when he ran on, he thought... He had the presence of mind to think, I know what, I'll take that bottle, wee in it, and then give it back to the keeper. The supporter's facing a ban from watching his team. I hope so. Yes, Barry.
If the keeper picked it, because normally if someone weed in your water bottle, it would be warm. Mm. So you'd kind of guess, ooh, something's not right
but
here.
But
if you're wearing those big, thick gloves.
Yeah. You'd know pretty soon.
I mean, the key part of that story, which I notice isn't mentioned, did the keeper drink from it?
Yeah, I don't have those details. But it's something to think about, isn't it? In League One, leaders Wigan won at Plymouth, and Blackburn are now second after winning at Fleetwood. They leapfrog Shrewsbury, who drew at home to Doncaster. Bottom side Bury ended a run of 8 defeats in all competitions with a win at Oxford. That was enough for Oxford to sack their manager, Pep Clotet. After less than 7 months in charge, assistant head coach Derek Fazakerley, that's where he is, has been placed in temporary charge. Oxford are 10th in the table, 8 points adrift of the playoff positions. In League Two, Luton are top. Notts County lost at home but remained second, wins for Accrington in thirds, and all the sides who are now in the playoffs. Bottom side Barnet ended a run of defeats with a draw against Lincoln. Sadly for them, the two sides above them both won, Chesterfield and Forest Green. Forest Green inched past Cambridge United 5-2. That'll do for part two. We'll start part three with Sid. Welcome back to part three. Before we say hello to Sid, great news if you are in or near Dublin on February the 27th. We are doing our second live show of the live show tour on the panel. Glendenning, Wilson, Rone. The four of us will be in Dublin on the 27th of February. We'll put a link on the website. Come and buy tickets. We'll tweet all about it. And then you can find out the truth about what really happens on the pod. But let's go now to Spain. Say hello to Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous, thanks. I'm going to begin with this question. Would you describe yourself as a bad boy?
Don't think so. No, why?
Well, we were trying to work out who the baddest of the bad boys of the pod was. And did you suggest Sid, Philippe?
Yes, I did. Mm. I thought I could imagine Sid in a kind of bad boy in person, you know, persona or whatever. With the right clothes and...
Yeah, Barry thought maybe... Barry's... The bar is just, do you chew gum? That's basically, it's the squarest set of people that have ever been put in the same place. But I said I'd ask you that first, Sid, so sorry to throw it at you.
That's all right.
We can talk about the football now if you want. Big wins for Real and Barcelona. Barca 5-0 at Real Betis. Messi's finish for the fourth, and his little pass for Suarez at the end were just glorious, weren't they?
Yeah, and that's not even the best moment from Messi in a game that in which he was brilliant, especially in the second half. But there's a moment when he gets the ball deep near his own half, around about the kind of top right corner of his own penalty area. Then he sort of turns one way and turns back again and then goes back again and kind of comes out of this circle of Betis players with the ball. And you actually hear the stadium kind of do an intake of breath. And then there's this roar and they start applauding him. The Betis fans are watching their team get absolutely destroyed by Barca. And they actually play really well, Betis, for about 50 minutes. But Messi comes away from it. Away from them with the ball, and after the game, there was a couple of really quite nice remarks from the Betis players, which I think sum it up pretty well. You had Antonio Dan, the goalkeeper, saying, "Well, Messi just makes this sport a better place." And Joaquin post game, immediately after the game, on the touchline, and he starts to talk about the game, and you know, he's kind of rambling a little bit, and he says, "You know, and when you're up against a player like Messi, who, and he just starts laughing. He says, "Well, you know, truth is, there's not really anything else we can say about him."
A friend of mine was saying he believes you can judge if a person is good or bad by whether they prefer Messi or Ronaldo. And Federer and Nadal, he says. If you're in the Federer-Messi camp, you're not a good human. And if you're in the Nadal-Ronaldo camp, you're not...
I would be inclined to agree with your friend.
I'd be interested to know why the rejection of Nadal. Now, I say this obviously from a Spanish perspective, or up to a point from a Spanish perspective at least, and I don't know anything about tennis. In fact, pretty much I know about as little about tennis as Joaquin does. Famously, the best player was in an interview once with, I can't remember which TV station it was, and he said, "So what do you like to do apart from play football?" He says, "Oh, I'm a really big tennis fan." And you hear this giggling behind the camera, and it's Julio Baptista going, "What are you talking about? You don't play tennis, you complete liar." To which Joaquin, still on camera, still being recorded, turns around and says, "Julio, I've never even picked up a racket in my life." And everyone's, of course, rolling around going, "You absolute shite hawk, coming up with this, you know, this total lie." Anyway, so I know nothing about tennis, but certainly it's true that when you hear Nadal talk, when you listen to him, he's very, very impressive. It's very difficult not to like him, as I say, from a Spanish perspective.
I think it's just the pure naturalness, if that's a word, of Federer and Messi compared to sort of the hard work of a Nadal and a...
That in its own way is quite admirable, isn't it?
True, yeah.
People who've kind of made it maybe not with quite the same degree of natural gift, but have had the relentlessness and the ambition to kind of overcome that, which isn't to say either of them are not talented, because of course they're ridiculously talented, but maybe not to the same extent.
On the pitch for Real, Gareth Bale scored a lovely goal, didn't he? Modric too. Ronaldo cut his face scoring a header and then took a selfie as he was being treated.
Yeah, I mean, that's cool. I mean, obviously it's a really interesting, it's a really great image. You've got Ronaldo goes down, he gets up and he's bleeding, he's walking off with the doctor, and he says, there's a little bit of footage that you see him say, "How bad is it? You know, is it a lot? What's happened? What's on my face?" And the doctor sort of trying to explain. So he takes the phone and does it and looks at himself with a selfie. It seems to me that seems like a logical thing to do. If there isn't a mirror, that's one way of seeing what it looks like, one way of being able to make a judgment call yourself. And he walks to the touchline, immediately kind of does a "right, I'm not carrying on" gesture. They stop momentarily and he goes straight down the tunnel. It's caused quite a stir, this, and obviously there's going to be endless what do you call these things? Are these memes or memes? Because everyone in Spain calls memes. Them memes, of course. Memes. Yeah, memes. All right, it's going to cause endless ones of those. But I, fundamentally, I don't actually think it's a bad thing to do at all. I remember an interview years ago with, I think it was Michael Stipe, saying that the dinner party, to check he hasn't got food stuck in his teeth, he'd hold the knife very close to his teeth and look at his reflection. This is just a more modern version of that, isn't it?
It's true. I've never seen Michael Stipe with food in his teeth. So, you know, I suppose it works, doesn't it? Philippe, you have a question?
Yes, but when he took this selfie, was he smiling?
No.
That would be... That is, for me, the litmus test. If he's smiling...
No, he's kind of holding it to the side of his head where the cut is.
And, okay,
and by the way, does anyone...
Right.
Is it possible to smile in a selfie? Also, I mean, maybe I'm just proving what an old git I am now, but... it's kind of quite difficult to hold the phone properly and press the little button, isn't it, at the same time?
Well, I got the impression he wasn't taking a selfie. He was just merely using the phone more as
selfie
a mirror
function.
To see how bad
function.
The cut on his head was.
It looks like, yeah.
Hello, if you can't take a selfie, you can't be the bad boy of this lot. A big win for Las Palmas beating Valencia.
Yeah, and a big shock that as well, because I mean, admittedly, it partly happens because Gabriel, of course, the former Arsenal player, manages to get himself sent off for two yellow cards in about 30 seconds. So he's absolutely bawling at the referee, screaming in his face for what, in fairness to him, does look like a pretty ropey penalty that he's given away. The referee gets the yellow card out, so he just carries on. Just keeps on going. So the referee says, oh, have another one. And as he walks off the pitch, you can see his manager sort of standing behind him like, you dickhead.
You sent a tweet, Sid, saying that La Liga, i.e. the whole league, have signed nine Saudi Arabian players who each go to a Spanish club. Then you wrote what in capitals with a question mark, which is precisely the question I have. What?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, so basically this is part of an agreement that La Liga has with, I can't remember the exact word. I think it's the Saudi Sporting Authority, it's called, and the Spanish and the Saudi FA. And there's an agreement between the league and them to help develop football in Saudi Arabia. Now, presumably, of course, in return for enormous amounts of money. And basically what happened was that yesterday afternoon, a series of clubs announced at the same time, so in Levante's case, we've signed this guy, and in Villarreal's case, we've signed this guy, and in Sporting's case, we've signed this guy. Although Sporting's case is quite funny, and here's a good sign as to just how much these clubs really, really wanted these players. Sporting announced they'd signed the club that they'd got their player from. They didn't know the difference between the player's name and the club's name. And so that kind of suggests that maybe this isn't something that clubs were necessarily that keen on. And so this all gets announced at once. So basically, the league has this agreement, and then these players, you know, the players go to certain clubs. Now, of course, what happens is they come officially on loan, so it costs the club nothing. It's obviously we don't know because the league. The response that I got from the league about half an hour ago actually was, I've got nothing to add apart from what was in the statement yesterday. Nothing to add, despite the fact there are endless questions about this. You know, who decides it? Who decides which clubs get the players? Do the clubs actually want these players? Who's paying for these? How much money is being paid here? Does this form part of the club's budget? We've been told it doesn't. So a whole load of Saudi, well, I'd say nine in total, a couple of them in fairness. I think it's three in the first division, three in the second division, and three in the second division B. A couple of them are very young. But yeah, for the next 6 months, there will be some Saudi players in La Liga. Whether or not they'll play, of course, we'll see. And of course, that's one of the other questions. Is there a criteria here that says that the clubs are obliged to pay them a certain amount?
Actually, it reminds me of, I think this is true, that the South Korean ice hockey team, female ice hockey team, have just been given 10 North Korean ice hockey players who they've never met. They don't know if they're any good or not. And then the coach, just before the Olympics, has to decide, do I have to play a North Korean ice hockey? Should I not play one? What if I don't play any of them? What happens then? So it's totally bizarre, isn't it? Hey, Sid, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Have a lovely day, Sid Lowe. Paolo, Italy. I saw a piece in The Observer, what you wrote, saying Napoli are starting to believe in a first Scudetto since Maradona.
Yeah, and subsequent to me writing that, I had this horrible feeling that I was going to jinx them this weekend, because they had a really tough game this weekend. One of those sort of underrated tough games, away to Atalanta, who won three out of their last four head-to-heads, including a Coppa Italia game just at the start of this month. An Atalanta team who just have been punching above their weight for a good more than 18 months under Gasperini, really very, very hard team to beat and had already taken points off both Juventus and Lazio at home. So it was one of those games which looked like it could be one where they'd slip up. And actually, Napoli really, I thought, handled it with the maturity again of a team that looks like they're deadly serious about taking this all away, because it wasn't their prettiest performance of the year. It was a 1-0 win. It was a Dries Mertens goal that was on the line of offside, but really nice finish, which has also been photographed just perfectly. There's this picture going around where he's sort of in midair striking this ball. They got a goal from him, which was a big moment for him as well, because he hadn't scored since October. In fact, brilliantly put on Instagram over the brief 1 week pause I just had in Italy, had a picture of himself on the beach saying, "Don't worry, all my fantasy owners, I'm getting some good relaxation," and then comes back and scores a goal for them. So, you know, I thought it was a nice little nod to people who probably have no right to demand things of him, but nevertheless. They never risked anything against Atalanta. Again, Atalanta scored, two against Juventus, three against Lazio. They never really gave them a sniff of getting into the game. And I think they're just really impressive this season, Napoli. And it's one of those things where they were, I know you hate calendar years, Max, but they were the best team in Italy in 2017. And they just need to make this last. But the problem is they are a much thinner squad than Juventus. They are under intense pressure in Naples, which is a city that is crazy for football and is just building up and up at the moment. But they deserve something to show for this period, because they've been exceptional now for more than 12 months.
I'm not sure if smugness is the right word, but I'll say a smugness in Italy that at least there are two teams going for the title, is unlike any other of the big leagues.
There's satisfaction in Italy that there's a competitive title race, which there hasn't always often been. I mean, someone asked me this question the other day: is this the sort of hardest title challenge that Juventus have had since Ibrahimovic was at Milan? And it's funny, because actually there was one year, Rudy Garcia's first year at Roma, where Roma were really good actually, and they got to, I think, 85 points, and that's losing the last two or three games when the title was already done. But that year Juventus got to 100, so it didn't feel close, even though Roma were really good. So yeah, Italy has been waiting a long time for this title race, for a real intense title race, and people are enjoying it. It's compelling. Right now, Juventus in second place are on course for, if you extrapolate out current pace, 95 points, and they're in second. Huh. It's something.
I had to do an article last week on competitive leagues in Europe, you know, because so few of them are being reduced to the status of one or two horse races. And of Turkey is basically the one you want to watch if you're looking for, because there's four teams basically all within a point or two of each other, or at least there were before the weekend. And that league, unlike others, like Poland's very tight, Cyprus, Greece, quite a lot of them split, you know, at the end of the regular season and then have these playoffs and stuff. But Turkey and Greece are both very ones to keep an eye on.
And for Ryan Babel.
And of course,
to keep up. And before we go to Philippe's French boulangerie, a question on Benevento, while we're still in the Italian piazza. Yep. Everyone's fallen in love with them, really, because they've been so useless. are they still as useless as they have been? I see they have 7 points.
Yeah, there was a little bit of hope at the end of the year, sort of tipping over into the new year, because they beat Chievo and then Sampdoria in back-to-back games. And people were thinking, is this going to be like Crotone last year, who came back from a very, very deep hole and survived? But they got walloped 3-0 by Bologna at the weekend, so I'm thinking less so. Just to sort of quickly piggyback on Baz and the point about competitive title races. Of course, in Italy, we were talking about Inter and Roma in this title race until very recently as well. They played each other on Sunday night and drew. So it's very much now it's about Napoli and Juventus rather than those two.
Philippe,
I have a question for Paolo.
Wow.
If I may.
Absolutely.
No, because you mentioned Dries Mertens. I mean, you can edit it out because it's my personal curiosity. Is the story that there's a clause in his contract which would make him available for something like 28 million euros? Is it complete poppycock? Because I can't understand there hasn't been a rumour. He's one of the best strikers on the planet.
Yeah, I need to check the details on this. It's in that ballpark, but it's specific to times of year, and I'm pretty sure it can't be triggered in January. But there is a clause, and it's not a lot of money. And if someone wanted to in the summer, I believe it could be it could be triggered.
Philippe, oui. So the French Quarter. PSG lost.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen very often.
No, it's happened once this season against Strasbourg, which took everybody by surprise, and they had been complacent. This was different because they were playing at Lyon, which is basically the anti-PSG club, with Jean-Michel Aulas, the chairman, who is very vocal about his that he doesn't like Qatar Saint-Germain. And terrific game. And three absolutely magnificent, ridiculously magnificent goals. I mean, Paolo and I were wondering which one was the best before the pod. I think we voted for Kurzawa's volley first. Then I think Fekir's free kick and perhaps Memphis Depay in the last minute.
So that's be the worst goal in a game. Shows they have some good goals in a game. Because it's a lovely finish from Depay.
No, I mean, they're all absolutely wonderful. And actually, maybe Depay should have been ahead of Fekir, but I have a very weak spot for Fekir. A game also marked by Dani Alves's quite extraordinary sending off. I don't know if you saw the images of that, but...
Well, explain what happened.
Well, he did a really bad foul on the Lyon player, and obviously free kick, and... I think the ref was about to take a yellow card out of his pocket, and Alves literally came to the referee and nearly headbutted him, shouting at him. And the ref said, yellow? No. Red. Off you go, my friend. And so PSG finished with 10 men. And
also possible that Steve Morrison quickly rung him and goaded him into making that decision.
It's very good to see Lyon, you know, prospering again. They've had a difficult, well, sort of uneasy start to the season. There was the loss of Lacazette as well. People thought, well, how are they going to cope with that? And the answer that they're coping extremely well. And now they're only 8 points behind PSG, and they've only lost two games, like PSG.
Lyon prospering, Lille not prospering at all.
It's appalling. So they've lost again. They lost 1-0 at Troyes, and they're now 18th. So they're in the orange zone, not red zone, orange zone. And what is going on there is nothing short of scandalous, basically. You might remember that, obviously, they had Marcelo Bielsa as their manager, who was basically relieved of his duties when he went to visit one of his best friends who was dying. He actually died in Argentina, and the club crassly used this as an explanation, as a means to basically sack him without paying any money, which is really, really elegant. I mean, the fact that the results were very poor under Bielsa, you can't hide it. But the whole, when you think of that club, which is the club with Gervinho and Hazard, which really was so seductive and won the French title and so on, with Rudy Garcia, and that was a Champions League regular. And what's happened to it is just shocking. It's been sold to a group of people who are basically asset strippers, and who've got a chairman, Monsieur Lopez, who is supposedly the owner. He's not the owner, and it's all been financed by a loan by Elliott, you know, the hedge fund, one of the worst ones.
Have their fingers on Milan.
Exactly, with such success as well. And the idea was to use Lille, I think, as a kind of farm, a player farm, and it's collapsing. And we risk to have, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. This is one of the great French clubs. I mean, historically speaking, it's hugely important. And what's happening to it is just nothing short of scandalous and very, very, very sad. And you can't see how it's going to change with Galtier in charge. I just don't have any idea. They don't have the players. They don't have the structure. They've got this beautiful stadium, which they can't fill. And they're on their way to Ligue 2. And then afterwards, who knows what's going to happen?
Some breaking transfer news. Producer Jonathan tells me that Lassana Diarra.
Yeah, I've heard about this one.
Who was most recently at Al Jazeera in the UAE. Is having a medical at PSG.
Yeah. Yes. Well, they badly need somebody to cover in this kind of position. Diarra is an enigma. I mean, I'll never understand how somebody could wreck his own career like this. He was a wonderful player at Arsenal, could have said at Arsenal, took so many wrong decisions, wrong turns, can still do a great job. Because if you look at PSG, this is one area where they definitely need some reinforcements, especially if they want to go as far as possible in the Champions League. Because if you look, you know, they play usually as well. It would be Thiago Motta and Verratti and Rabiot, who is terrific. But I think they really lack a proper defensive midfielder. And why not Lassana Diarra?
He's only 32. I thought he was about 465. Or maybe Harry Redknapp was in charge of PSG, which is something I would like to see.
And of course, as well, he's French, which with the UEFA regulations does help.
In Germany, Bayern, 16 points clear at the top. 4-2 win over Werder Bremen, 2 from Lewandowski. He's on 17 goals this season in the league. Next player down with 13 is Aubameyang. Very tight below them. Four sides are on 31 points. Leverkusen, Schalke, Leipzig and Mönchengladbach. Two on 30, Dortmund and Eintracht Frankfurt. Cologne with 3 wins in a row now. 16 without win, 3 in a row. They beat Hamburg 2-0 away, but they're still bottom. In Scotland, Barry, a tiny Fitbar corner, which I watched. So I will tell to you and everyone else. Huge result for Hearts. Who did not have a great record against Hibs. They beat them in the Scottish Cup. A very late goal in the fourth round for Don Cowie scored it. It was a header from a corner and he got a tiny flick on it. And then a defender and the goalkeeper managed to push it out. But because of the spin on the ball rolls out and is going away from the goal and then just spins round and rolls so slowly and the fullback can't clear it in time. Craig Levein got very excited. Neil Lennon less so. So well done to
I am struggling to imagine what Craig Levein looks like in a state of excitement.
Similar to how Craig Levein looks, not in a state of excitement, but with a bit more jumping around.
His default setting is, you know, just dour, even by the standards of Scottish football managers. He's famously sent out a Scotland team with no striker, didn't he, to face, was it Czech Republic?
Is there something funny about you describing someone as dour?
No. Okay. Well, I don't think so. Okay. I'm not dour.
Okay. A part-time Brora Rangers from the Highland Leagues beat East Fife 1-0 and earned themselves a trip to Kilmarnock. So well done to them. Feedback corner, anybody, before we go home? Because this is where most sports journalists get their stories from. Regards to to Baz's Emporium, your shop, Baz.
Oh, okay.
Aaron 1000 says, we used to call the green taxi and book for a time and number of people. Turned out it wasn't even a cab, just a couple of kids on bicycles. Jack Thompson says, Barry's shop should be called Baz's Bazaar. Come on, Max, work the puns. Jack Ford says, I'm tentatively related to Phil Brown, granddad's cousin or some such, and I tan very easily. Perhaps it's genetic. And that'll do for today. I will include, which almost certainly won't make the edit, but if it does, good for you. I will include this from ID 432-4201. The content of this podcast is now often childish and puerile, with the discussion too often being diverted towards discussions unrelated to football, indicative only of the host's desire to indulge in unrelated subjects. The content of this podcast, when compared to other similar ventures elsewhere, lacks a focus on football discussion as well as erudite and informed comment, with many of the capable guests being repeatedly diverted, forced to discuss inane and childish topics. This is a terrible shame, as the Guardian Football Weekly podcast created a brand renowned for intelligent and insightful sports journalism, and it's difficult to understand why there has been, intentionally or otherwise, treated so lightly or consequently. After years of listening, I will now be stopping. Good luck all.
Well, I have two things to say to that. Mm. Whoever wrote that, James or McIntosh or whoever it was, clearly hasn't listened to a lot of Football Weekly since its inception 10 years ago. And B, they must be really good fun at parties.
Every part of me just wants to blow a raspberry.
Go away. We don't want you listening to our show.
Anyway, that'll do. Barry, thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Paola, thank you.
Cheers.
Philippe, thank you.
Merci.
Thank you, behind the glass, to you, producer Jonathan. Good luck with editing that into something that lasts only an hour. We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.